Chapter 11. Monday. The catchment area for Abbey Grange is wide and economically diverse. It is close enough to the city centre to touch some of the wealthier areas, but covers several suburbs of middling value and a few streets at its nether edge that properly belong in the backwater suburbs, wide crawling streets with vast gutters and unkempt grass. The poorer girls who work part-time in fast food and clothing chain stores are able to effect something of a moral victory over the girls who receive an allowance from their parents and don't have to work for cash. When the less wealthy girls visit the white and shining houses of the rich, they always come armed with a strong sense of entitlement, opening the fridge and changing the channel and taking long delicious showers in the morning, always with a guiltless and even pious sense of righting some dreadful inequality in the world. It is almost a noble thing to cajole and thieve half a bag of crisps from a girl whose pantry is lit by angled halogen bulbs anchored to a chrome bar. It is not a burglary, but a form of just redistribution, a restoration of a kind of balance. So the poorer girls tell themselves as they close their salty fists around their next mouthful and remark out loud that they are rostered on to work the late shift at the candy bar tonight. The richer girls are made to feel ashamed of their parents' wealth by these subtle, insidious means, and so they begin to overcompensate in justifying the incremented luxuries of their lives, defending each indulgence in terms of sole necessity. "We have to have fresh stone fruit because of Mum's diet plan," they say, or, "I have to have my own car because Dad's away on business so much," or, "We only had the spa put in because Dad's got a bad back." The repeated validations become their mantra, and soon the richer girls begin to believe the things that they are compelled by shame to say. They come to believe that their needs are simply keener, more specialised, more urgent than the needs of the girls who queue outside the chippy and tuck the greasy package down their shirts for the walk home. They do not regard themselves as privileged and fortunate. They regard themselves as people whose needs are aptly and deservedly met, and if you were to call them wealthy, they would raise their eyebrows and blink and say, "Well, it's not like we're starving or anything, but we're definitely not rich." This stubborn dance of entitlement, aggressive and defensive, does mark a real fear in the collective mind of the Abbey Grange girls who have moved through the years of high school in an unchanging unitary pack. Always they fear that one of them might at any time burst out and eclipse the others, that the group might suddenly and irreparably be plunged into her shadow, that the tacit allegiance to fairness and middling equality held by them all might come to nothing after all. In a group, their economic differences even out to an ordinary average, and their combined mediocrity becomes something a little like power, each of them with a specialised function that defines her territory within the whole. But if one of them should burst out and shine, the remaining girls would wither. They are mindful of the threat, clinging to each other's elbows and clustering bluishly in the corner and reining in any girl who threatens independence, any girl who looks as if she might one day break free and have no need of the rest. It is just such a group that Victoria rent apart and destroyed when she peeled off to pursue a love affair in such a selfish, secret way. In usual practice, boys are privately met and managed, but always remain the collective property of the group. Afterwards, a girl might talk only to her best friend, or perhaps a close few, according to her own network of allegiances and feuds. But it is at least accepted that she will tell somebody, that the boy will remain an object beyond the myriad confidences of the group, a thing to discuss but never confide in, never to trust. Victoria's violation of these rules is crippling and total. To have conducted an entire relationship in secret, to have invented commitments and appointments, and above all, to have trusted in Mr. Saladin over this nuggeted faction of girls who depend so utterly upon togetherness. Her betrayal weakens the kaleidoscope stronghold of the group, leeches everything of joy and meaning, punctures every illusion of unity and might. The girls begin to shrink away from each other. Even the St. Sylvester boys seem tame and foolish, like dress-up soldiers waving cardboard swords. "It isn't fair. is what the girls are thinking. All left behind, eclipsed girls who squat in the dark of Victoria's shadow and stew. What she stole from us, it isn't fair. Monday. Isolde wonders whether what she is feeling is merely a kind of worship, a fascinated admiration of an older girl, such as she once bestowed upon Victoria and her scornful train of friends, forever desperate to please them, clinging to their ankles like a foreshortened afternoon shadow, and breathless with the impossible hope that they might one day count her among their closest. Is Julia really only a mirrored image of the person whom Isolde aspires to be? Worldly, senior, brooding, debonair. Is this all her attraction is? A narcissistic self-congratulation? A girl captivated by the image of a girl? Does falling in love with Julia require Isolde to fall, to some degree, in love with herself? All she has is one uncertain evening of stalls and snatches and trailings off, a lone flare of something bright that sent her heart thudding and the blood rushing to the thin skin over the bones of her chest, and then days and weeks of lonely conjuring, a paralytic limbo of self-doubt which seems to shrink Julia to an impossibility, a freak, a daytime wonder that recedes in the rear-vision mirror of her uncertain mind. She thinks vaguely about how nice it would be to be persecuted. She thinks about the two of them parading in defiance in front of her parents, holding hands maybe. She thinks about watching her father pick at his red throat with his finger while he shakes his head and says, "Izzy, don't close off your options, honey. You never know, it might just be a phase." She thinks about her mother, her shrug, her careful smile. She thinks about her sister, who would fall quiet and look across at them and watch Julia so cautiously. Julia, who is properly her equal, her classmate, the girl she once scorned in the netball trials, the girl about whom she whispered once, "Doesn't she know what we all think of her? Surely she knows." It would be nice, Isolde thinks, to know that you had become the image you created for yourself. It would be nice to have a reason to act broody and maligned. Every one of Isolde's choices is really only a rephrased and masquerading version of the question, "What am I?" It will be this way for years to come. Tuesday. Sometimes Julia is filled with a kind of rage at the fact of her body, the fertile swell of her hips, her cold, freckled breasts, the twice-folded inner pocket of her womb. She doesn't wish herself different, doesn't crave a phallus or a moustache or a pair of big-veined hands with calluses and blunted nails. She simply feels frustrated that her anatomical apparatus presents such a misplaced and useless advantage. If the other girl's flushed and halting inclinations tend elsewhere, if Isolde does not seek a mirrored lover but a converse lover, a flip-side complement of a lover, then Julia is lost. Julia thinks, seducing Isolde isn't just a matter of behaving as attractively and as temptingly as possible and trusting that Isolde will bite. If instead she were faced with the prospect of seducing a boy, then such a simple formula would probably work. The mere fact of Julia's anatomy would be enough. She would herself be the temptation, her body, the whole of her. But seducing Isolde requires forcing the younger girl to come to regard herself in a new way. Only after Isolde has come to cherish her own self, the concave yin of her feminine skin, will Julia have a hope. Isolde must come to cherish herself first and foremost. The seduction must take the form of a persuasion, a gradual winning over of her mind. Julia thinks of all the usual gifts of courtship, like flowers in the homeroom, or stones thrown at her window at midnight, or a patient watcher at the school gates, waiting with a bicycle to walk her slowly home. All of them seem grotesque. She imagines sending Isolde flowers in homeroom, and all she can think of is the girl's horrified face as she peers over the lip of the red cluster of tissue, the card already plucked off in embarrassment and crumpled to a nub. She imagines a bouquet too big and too fragile to be shoved into the bottom of Isolde's bag, And the beautiful girls all laughing and shouting, "What's his name?" Julia is overcome by a fit of melancholy now and drives her pen savagely through the margin of her homework sheet, causing the paper to rip. She thinks, "What's the likelihood that the one girl who makes my heart race is the one girl who wants me in return? That the accident of my attraction coincides with the accident of hers?" She thinks, "Can I trust in something chemical, some scent or pheromone that will ride on the current of my walking and come to kiss her as I pass her by?" Julia distrusts this chemical, this invisible riptide that sucks away at all her shores. She thinks, "I cannot rely on the chemical. I cannot rely on the accident of her attraction. I must seduce her, actively pursue her and persuade her. I must appeal to the questionable autonomy of a teenage girl whose mind is still not rightfully her own." Tuesday. "Hey, Isolde, want to play?" someone calls out, and Isolde looks up. She is walking back from the tuck shop with a brown paper bag pinched in each hand, the icing slowly leaking through the paper and darkening the pale and greasy spots of grey. "No, thanks," Isolde says, and holds up the paper bags as an excuse. The questioning girl smiles and returns to the game. Isolde watches as she walks past. Four or five of them are attempting to play hacky-sack in their thick-soled school shoes and drooping grey socks, hiking up their school skirts with both hands to show the winter white of their dimpled knees. She rounds the corner of the school library and continues on. Isolde weaves her way around the groups of girls sitting in their impenetrable circles around the quad. And then, to her surprise, she sees Julia sitting in a rare patch of sun on the grass on the far side of the paving. She is wearing her headphones and squinting in a cross kind of way into a paperback novel. Shyly, Isolde makes her way towards her. Her heart begins to hammer. Julia looks up, sees her approaching, and tugs her headphones out of her ears. "Hey, man," she says, and Isolde waves her paper bags and says, "Hey."
"What have you got?" Julia says.
"Just a roll and a donut. You can sit down if you want." Isolde crosses her legs at the ankle and descends into a sitting position in the fluent scissor action of girls long practiced at sitting cross-legged, her free hand tugging at the doubled fold beneath the silver kilt pin so it covers the bare skin of her knee. Julia shifts her ankles to make room. The horizontal gash along the length of Isolde's filled roll is stained pink from the beetroot. Isolde wipes her finger along the seam to collect the mayonnaise and licks her finger carefully.
"You know what I think is shit?" Julia says suddenly, arching her back and reaching over to yank a tuft of grass from the ground to shred. "That they make you come to those counselling sessions about self-defence or teacher abuse or whatever."
"But I've learned so much," Isolde says, blinking. "Like my body is a temple, and we were all abused as children, probably. We only need to work hard to remember it."
Julia laughs and shreds her grass even smaller.
"But you were brilliant," Isolde says, standing up to him like that, like you did.
"He's scared of me now."
"So is everyone, after what you said," Isolde says, meaning it as a joke, but Julia frowns and shakes her head.
"I was paraphrasing anyway," she says. "It's not like I made it up, dumb shits. Not you."
"Oh no," Isolde says quickly. Her nervousness has given way to a kind of giddiness, a reckless, charged feeling that is keeping her heartbeat in her throat, and her vision sharpened in awareness of Julia's total proximity, the fall of her hair around her face, and the every movement of her hands as they pick away at the yellow balding patch of the lawn. Julia's hands are thin and reddish, with nibbled patches of dark nail polish in the centre of each flat nibbed nail. She has a few loops of dirty string knotted around her bony wrist, and on the back of her hand a few notes to herself in blue ink. Several days old now, so the ink has furred out into the web of tiny creases on her skin. Even looking at Julia's hands seems unbearably sensual to Isolde,
and she quickly draws her gaze away, out across the quad where a group of girls are clapping a rhythm as they rehearse a set for the school dance challenge. "We're the ones with the power," Julia is saying. "That's the real lesson from this whole Mr. Saladin thing, the lesson they don't want us to learn." "Oh," Isolde says, looking again at Julia's hands. "It's because of where we are in the power chain. We can be damaged, but we can't damage others. Well, I suppose we can damage each other, but we can't damage our teachers or parents or whatever. They can only damage us. And that means we get to call the shots." "What does calling the shots mean?" Isolde says. Julia tosses her head in a brooding way. "Everyone worships the victim," she says. "That's all I've learned from this place. Victim worship. In fourth form, I rode for the Coxed Quad in the Nationals, right? We turned up and we were clearly the worst team in the tournament. We just didn't have good enough gear. The quad was really old and heavy. We hadn't been training for long enough. But because we were the underdogs, we really believed we were going to win. Because that's what happens. In the last 10 seconds, the underdogs pull through and win by a canvas, and good triumphs over evil, and money doesn't matter in the end. I remember sitting there in the boat before the race with our oars ready, waiting for the buzzer and thinking, we're really going to show them when we win. But you didn't." "Of course not," Julia says. "Some rich school with a flash fiberglass boat won by about a mile. We were the last team over the finish by at least 45 seconds. But I'm just pointing out the victim thing. If you're the victim, you really do believe you're going to come out on top. It's what we learn here. Worship the victim. The loser will win." Isolde looks puzzled. She's a little in awe of the way Julia spits out her opinions, little rehearsed pieces that she delivers with her eyes flashing and her head cocked. Her opinion is more like a challenge than a point of view. "You know," Julia says, "back in the day, schools would have special desks for the brainiest kid in the class. But the brainiest kid isn't set apart anymore. Instead, we have remedial block, and the special needs block, and the careers and counselling building. They're the ones who are set apart from the rest." Isolde says, "You think people worship my sister?" "Yeah, I do," Julia says. Isolde looks sideways at the older girl and finds that she has nothing to say. She tugs a pale shard of ham out of her roll with her fingers and nibbles it carefully. "So what was it like?" Julia says, with Victoria. She's unwrapped a cereal bar but is eating it slowly, pinching off the sweaty grains between her thumb and forefinger and rolling them to a greasy ball one by one. The girls often eat in this mincing way when they're in nervous company. "What do you mean?" Isolde says. "I just meant she's your sister. Did she talk to you about it afterwards and stuff? Did you guess while it was happening? Is she going to be okay?" Julia's heart is beating fast. Her instinct is to act tougher than she feels, to make no concessions, to woo Isolde by a kind of reckless boldness, a brash and unapologetic ownership of hard opinion that will make the younger girl look up at her in awe. At the same time, Julia is bearing a thudding feeling of lonely vulnerability, a simple, childlike yearning to be touched, to be gathered up in the other girl's arms and kissed and crooned at. Even as she speaks aggressively, as she delivers her opinions and shrugs and scowls as if she doesn't care, a part of her is trying to show the other girl that she could be tender underneath, that she could be sweet and delicate and thirsty, that the animal precepts of her feminine nature are not quite lost. It's a strange thing to keep the two in balance, the appearance of hard with the appearance of soft. Julia feels ravaged by the effort, as if she might easily burst into tears at this very moment, sitting here on the grass. Isolde pinches half a moon of cucumber with her fingers and licks its dewy edge as she thinks about the question. She's about to reply when a shadow falls across the two of them, and they look up. It's the beautiful girls, and they are all smiling, thin little curved smiles that press their lips tight together into a cruel reversal of their usual slack-mouthed pout. "Got yourself a girlfriend at last, Julia," the most beautiful girl says. "Going to take her home to show your mum." Julia looks up at her and says nothing. Isolde is looking from face to face and trying to decide whether she should smile, even a bit. She going to brush away some cobwebs? The beautiful girl says again. Clean you out a bit, is that the idea? They snicker. Isolde's almost smile fades a little. Did you dial her in? Slip her some cash for the privilege. Oh, for fuck's sake, are you like 12? Julia snaps. She reaches for her headphones and her paperback and begins packing her bag to leave. No, says the beautiful girl's sidekick, stepping forward in a moment of rare glory. But she is, isn't she? She points at Isolde, and Isolde feels herself turn scarlet. She wonders whether she should point out that she's actually 15, or whether that would simply give them ammunition for another joke. All the beautiful girls laugh. Julia looks thoroughly irritated at her own mistake and continues shoving the remains of her lunch into her bag. I guess you couldn't find anyone your own age who was keen, says the sidekick. Julia says, Just fuck off, Tiffany. Whatever you're trying to do, you're not doing it. Fuck off. So if she's the tough one, the beautiful girl says, turning now to Isolde, what does that make you? The feminine one? Isn't that the way it works? There always has to be a man and a woman anyway, like a big old game of pretend. Isolde, nervous and caught between public denial and public defence of something she doesn't yet understand, simply tries to smile, a nervous, tight-lipped smile that the beautiful girls evidently take as confirmation of the taunt. The leader casts around for something further to say, but ends up just saying, Faggots, as a way of punctuating the scene, and flounces off with her servants in her wake. The group of them spear across the quad like a tiny blue comet, its head bright and beautiful, and its ragged tail getting duller and more ordinary as it trails away. Cunts, says Julia under her breath, and she tugs savagely at the zipper of her school bag. Sorry, says Isolde. Sorry, says Julia. The first bell rings, but Julia and Isolde make no move to rise. They sit on the grassy verge side by side and shred grass. I heard she had a nose job anyway, Isolde said. The main girl, last year. Can I have a bit of your doughnut? Julia says, because underneath it all, the ordinary rules of thieving still apply. Tuesday. The role of Mrs. Bly requires a fat suit and special latex pouches that slip into either cheek to fatten the jaw. The fat suit is impeccable. It's made mostly of silicone, sculpted especially for the woman's frame, and it is heavy enough to make her stagger when she walks. She is wearing a tubular denim skirt that buttons up the front and a gold link necklace with a slender golden charm. And she has rouged her fattened cheeks and sprayed her hair with scented mist. She waddles gracefully into the room and descends upon one of the armchairs, sighing and reaching down to rub her artificially fattened calf. Can't even tell it's a fat suit. The saxophone teacher almost forgets to speak. She's so busy admiring the effect. You were recommended to me by one of the Tupperware mothers, said Mrs. Bly. She said her daughter swapped over to you after the whole scandal at the school, and she's been very pleased. I'm glad, the saxophone teacher says. Yes, I've had a considerable influx of students this year from Abbey Grange. Wasn't the whole business just terrible, Mrs. Bly says, and she puckers her lips and squints her eyes and gives a merry chuckle. Catalytic, the saxophone teacher says, in pretended agreement, guessing that Mrs. Bly won't pause for long enough to think about the word. She doesn't. It was just terrible, she says again. The girl is ruined. She's damaged goods now, and all the girls are keeping their distance, of course. As they should be, the saxophone teacher says. Because it spreads like a virus, and that's what I said to my girls, Mrs. Bly says, drawing the vast spread of denim over her knee and puckering her lips to form a thatched smile that draws all the wrinkles around her lips into a single central nub. That kind of stain doesn't come out in the wash. The saxophone teacher suddenly feels weary. She sits down. Mrs. Bly, she says, remember that these years of your daughter's life are only the rehearsal for everything that comes after. Remember that it's in her best interest for everything to go wrong. It's in her best interest to slip up now while she's still safe in the green room with the shrouded furniture and the rows of faceless polystyrene heads and the cracked and dusty mirrors and the old paper scudding across the floor. Don't wait until she's out in the savage white light of the floods where everyone can see. Let her practice everything in a safe environment with a helmet and knee pads and packed lunches. And you at the end of the hall with the door cracked open a half inch in case anyone cries out in the long hours of the night. The spiderweb lasso of creases around fat Mrs. Bly's mouth loosens slightly. The good news, the saxophone teacher says briskly, turning now to her diary, is that I have an opening on Wednesday afternoon, if that suits your daughter's schedule. One of my students was hit by a car. Oh, isn't it dangerous, Mrs. Bly says. I don't let Rebecca cycle. I flat out refuse to let her cycle anywhere. Wednesday afternoon is perfect. At four? At four, Mrs. Bly chuckles again. She'll be so pleased, she says. She's practiced so hard to get her clarinet up to scratch, and she's wanted this so badly. It's as if for the first time in her life something has just begun to blossom. Friday. I suppose you didn't know Bridget, the saxophone teacher says to Isolde one afternoon. The girl who died. She was the year above in sixth form. She was one of my students. Oh, Isolde says. No, I didn't know her. She stalls a moment, looking clumsy and rocking back and forth on her heels. Are you okay? She asks finally, wincing to show a kind of concern. Wasn't it a great shock? The saxophone teacher says. Yeah, Isolde says. Everyone must be terribly upset, at your school and so forth. Oh, Isolde says. Yeah, they had an assembly.
Just an assembly?
And they flew the flag at half-mast.
I suppose everyone is still terribly upset, the saxophone teacher says. Skipping class, weeping, remembering everything that was irreplaceable about Bridget.
I suppose so. She was in the year above. I don't know anyone that knew her.
Isolde is wearing the half-stricken expression of someone who was required but ill-equipped to offer condolence or advice about death. She shuffles uncomfortably and looks at the floor. Bridget, the saxophone teacher says abruptly, changing tack, was my least favourite student. Bridget had a way of bucking and rearing her pelvis when she played that I privately found a little distasteful. Bridget would lean back with her knees bent and her eyes closed, tensing up and preparing to catapult her weight forward onto the balls of her feet, the saxophone rearing up like a golden spume about to break and fall. The muscles in her jaw were tight. I bent over Bridget's notebook to avoid looking at her, scribbling curt bullet points in the margin for her to remember in practice. Tone, I wrote, and then underneath, brightness. Shyly, almost respectfully, Isolde slips out of herself and becomes Bridget. Not the real Bridget, just a placeholder, a sight for the saxophone teacher to aim at, a figure to address. She stands hand-dog in the middle of the room with her sax tucked against her hip and her hair across her face. She doesn't speak. This was the last time I saw Bridget, the saxophone teacher says. She came to the end of the old castle and removed the sax from her mouth, shoving her lower jaw forward and back several times as if repositioning a set of dentures. She'd practiced. She always practiced. That was one of the things I didn't like about Bridget so much. I asked her, "What did you learn in counselling today?" And Bridget said, "This week we were talking about guilt and about how guilt can be illuminating. We're doing role plays based on ideas about guilt." "Guilt," I said. And Bridget said, rushing on with this rare flash of pleasure that she was owning the spotlight, that the voice she was using was for once her own and worth hearing, she said, "Guilt is really important. It's the first step on the road to something better." Isolde's toes are ever so slightly pigeoned, her knees inward turning and her hips awkwardly thrust. She rubs the bell of her sax with her finger and looks at the saxophone teacher's shoes. "So," I said, the sax teacher says, "Bridget, I think you're being deceived. Guilt is primarily a distraction. Guilt is a feeling that distracts us from deeper, truer feelings. Let me give you an example. You might feel guilty if you become attracted to someone who is forbidden to you. You feel attraction, and then you remember you're not allowed to be attracted to this person, and then you feel guilt. Which do you think is the more primary of these feelings, attraction or guilt?
I guess attraction, said Bridget, because it came first.
And I said, good. Guilt is secondary. Guilt is a surface feeling. Isolde nods a tiny nod to show she's listening. The saxophone teacher is glazed over now, the memory filling her vision like a glossy cataract over each staring eye. I said that, she says, because Bridget was my least favourite student. I said that because I didn't care for Bridget much at all. The memory dissolves and her vision sharpens once again. What have you learned in counselling? She says, rounding on Isolde with a savage, narrowed look, and the girl blinks and straightens and returns invisibly to herself. Isolde is not sure what answer she should give. As she hesitates and paws uncomfortably at the sacks around her neck, she thinks about the girl, the one assembly and the one half-masted flag, the never-scheduled counselling sessions about her death, and the paper cut-out convenience grief that some of the older girls wielded for a week or so, just to earn a half-hour's freedom and a pass to the nurse. The saxophone teacher is still looking hard at Isolde, waiting for an answer. Isolde says, quietly and full of shame, in counselling, we all mourn everything that was irreplaceable about my sister. We grieve for everything about Victoria that is now lost. Monday. Julia comes straight to her lesson from afternoon detention. She is almost late, and when the saxophone teacher opens the door, Julia is still red-faced and sweating a little, her cycle helmet trailing from her wrist. My teacher is an arsehole, she says in summary, once they are inside. Mrs. Paul is an arsehole. They have to write a reason on the detention slip, and I said, why don't you write saying out loud what everyone was thinking anyway? So she made it double. I fucking hate high school. I hate everything about it. Why did you get detention in the first place? The saxophone teacher says admiringly. But Julia just shakes her head and scowls. She takes a moment to unwrap and to fish for her music, and the saxophone teacher stirs her tea and tilts her head as she waits. When you leave and all of this is over, the saxophone teacher says, you will always have one school teacher you will remember for the rest of your life. One teacher who changed your life.
I won't, Julia says. I've never had a teacher like that.
You will have, the saxophone teacher says. Once you've got a few years' distance and you can look back cleanly, there will be some Miss Pammond, Miss Gillespie. There will be some teacher you remember above all the others, one teacher who rises ahead above them all. Julia is looking sceptical. The saxophone teacher waves her arm and continues. But how many teachers are lucky enough to have had one student who changed their lives? She says. One student who really changed them. Let me tell you something. It doesn't happen. The inspiration goes one way. It only ever goes one way. We expect our teachers to teach for the love of it, to inspire and awaken and ignite without any expectation of being inspired and awakened in return. We expect that their greatest and only hoped-for joy would be perhaps a student returning after 10 or 20 years, dropping by one morning to tell them just how much of an influence they were, and then disappearing back to the private success of their own lives. That's all. We expect our teachers every year to start anew, sever a year's worth of progress and forged connection, to unravel everything they've built and move back to begin work on another child. Every year our teachers sow and tend another thankless crop that will never, ever come to harvest.
I'm not a child, Julia says.
Young adult, the saxophone teacher says. Whatever you like.
I've never been inspired or ignited, Julia says.
But you see my point, the saxophone teacher says.
No, I don't, Julia says sourly. You get paid, it's just like any other job.
The sax teacher leans forward and crosses her legs at the knee.
Your mother, she says, wants a progress report. She wants me to describe how I have inspired you, how I have awoken you, how I have coaxed you on to a glorious path towards excellence and industry and worth.
Secretly, she also wants me to tell her just how much you have inspired me. Not directly, but in a roundabout, subtle way, as if I'm a little abashed, made a little vulnerable, as if we're talking about something dreadfully taboo. She wants me to lie a little. So lie. She wants, the saxophone teacher continues, what all the mothers want. She wants me to tell her that you and I have a special rapport, that you tell me things you wouldn't tell anybody else. She wants me to tell her that I see something in you, Julia, that I haven't seen in years. She wants me to say that our relationship functions for both of us as a shared or double birth, not the mere instruction of a pupil, but the utter opening of one person to another. So give her what she wants, Julia says. She is stubborn and difficult today, still wearing the injustice of her double detention like a surly veil around her face. She stands ready with her saxophone fitted around her neck. All right, let's get started, the saxophone teacher says, not without irritation. Play me something loud. Thursday. I think two of my students are having a love affair, is what the saxophone teacher would say to Patsy if Patsy were here. It would be brunch, as it always is with Patsy, and it would be a Thursday, and the sun would be shining slantwise through the tall windows and filling the apartment with lazy, dusty light. With each other, you mean? Patsy would say, leaning forward and putting both elbows on the table and her chin upon her hands. Yes, the saxophone teacher says. I introduced them at the concert. They're schoolmates. Well, one girl is 2 years older, but they attend the same school. Oh, yes, says Patsy. There always has to be an age difference at the beginning. With same-sex relationships, it's an initiation rite. You need an inequality of experience or you never get anywhere. Really? Says the saxophone teacher. Definitely, says Patsy. If you don't have gender roles to fall back on, you need the power to be organised somehow. You need a structure, teacher and pupil, predator and prey, something like that. She throws her head back and laughs suddenly, a clear, delighted laugh that peals out in the tiny flat like a bell. I knew you would laugh, the saxophone teacher says. She's petulant today and cross with how Patsy has been tossing her hair over her shoulder and sucking the smear of butter off her index finger and behaving for the most part like a person who thoroughly enjoys being desired. Have they said anything to you? Patsy says. Not directly, but well, you know. Showing all the symptoms. Yes, exactly. Patsy ponders this for a moment, in a contented sort of way, and then asks, Is it the girl who had the sister in the newspaper? Yes, the younger girl is old. Her older sister was abused. That makes it even more likely then, Patsy says. Does it? Definitely, for all sorts of reasons. The two of them sit for a moment in silence. The newspaper is spread over the breakfast things, peeking over the jam jar and the syrup bottle, creased and grease-spotted with marmalade and oil. There is a single strawberry left in the bottom of the thin plastic punnet, flat-edged like the snout of a cold chisel and frosted white with unripeness. I just want to get to the truth behind it, that's all. The kernel of truth behind everything, the saxophone teacher says suddenly into nothing. Friday. Dad's trying to connect, Isolde says, with a special weariness that she reserves for parental efforts to connect. It's part of his rebuilding thing. He wants to know more about us, both of us. Is that good? The saxophone teacher says. Last night he comes in while I'm watching TV and goes, Hey, Isolde, do you have a boyfriend? Isolde snickers unkindly. I only laughed because he said hey. So jolly and casual, like he'd practiced it in the mirror or something. I said, yes, and he clapped his hands and said, well, great, let's have the man round for dinner. You said yes, the saxophone teacher says. She has stiffened and is looking at Isolde with her head cocked and one hand hanging limp from the wrist, like a caricature of a startled pet. Yeah, Isolde says suspiciously, tucking her hair behind her ear. It's only been a few weeks, but yeah. The saxophone teacher makes a little twitching motion with her hand, gesturing Isolde onward. Isolde rolls her tongue out over her bottom lip and regards the saxophone teacher a moment longer before continuing. Everything's about eating together now, she says. Eating together as a family solves everything. We do it like a ritual. Nobody's allowed to touch their food until everyone's sat down. And then we all thank Mum and pass the sauce and whatever. Dad says eating together is the answer. If we had eaten together from the beginning, then Victoria would never have bumped accidentally on purpose into Mr. Saladin in the hall and let her breasts rub against his chest for the briefest half second before stepping back and saying, "Oh, sorry, I'm such a klutz." If we'd eaten together from the beginning, then Mr. Saladin would never have bitten his lip and ducked his head whenever Victoria looked at him, that shy schoolboy flirt effect that he'd been using since the 80s, but it still worked a charm. If we'd eaten together, Victoria would never have sucked on his fingertips and pushed her tongue down into the V between his first two fingers and made him gasp. None of it would have happened. "I didn't know you had a boyfriend," the Sax teacher says. "And none of us ever have anything to talk about at the table," Isolde says. "Not even Dad. He just ends up spieling about his work and everyone switches off and tries to eat as fast as possible." "How did you meet him?" the Sax teacher says. "By accident," Isolde says, "just around." "He should come to the recital next month," the saxophone teacher says, still peering at Isolde with a new hard look on her face. "Come and watch you play." "Yeah," Isolde says, bending the word like a sucked harmonica note so she manages to sound indifferent and aloof. "Is he in your year at school?" the sax teacher says. "Oh no," Isolde says smugly. "He's left school. He's an actor at the Drama Institute," and she waves an airy hand out the curtained window to the buildings on the far side of the courtyard. The lights change suddenly, and the saxophone teacher can see it, playing out like someone else's home video in front of her, furry and striped with grainy black. "He's an actor," Isolde's father is saying. "That's what I said," Isolde says. "He's at the Drama Institute." "That's what I said." "How old is he?" "Only first year, Dad," Isolde says, trying to look charming. "I certainly hope he doesn't expect you to have sex with him." "Dad, because you're only 15," Isolde's father says, speaking loudly and clearly, as if Isolde is partly deaf. "If you were to sleep with him, that would be a crime." "Dad!" "I'm going to ask you now," Isolde's father says, his eyes wide. "I'm going to ask you now, and I want you to give me a straight answer. Have you slept with him?"
"Dad, stop it, it's gross."
Isolde is inspired by a rare shaft of genius and says,
"It's like you want to even everything out. Play it fair. Do by me as you've done by Victoria. Crime for crime. Stop it."
"Why are you sidestepping my question?"
"Why are you talking to me like that? Can I talk to Mum?"
"You've slept with him."
"Great, you've decided. Now you'll never believe me, whatever I say."
"You're only 15. Can I talk to Mum?" "Isolde," says Isolde's father sadly, "I never had sisters. Throw me a bone." The lights return to normal, restoring a yellowish afternoon light to the studio, and the saxophone teacher blinks as if awakening. "The Institute," she says. "That's supposed to be very hard to get into, isn't it? He must be rather good."